ICBC, as you know, stands for Iowa Can Be Cold. And I'm Dr. Jim Wilder. I come to you from sunny California. And there I work at a center called Shepherd's House, which is a pastoral care center. And our objective there is to bring the life model to life. We've looked to develop a model that explains life from birth to death, and from our life without Christ to a life with Christ. We try to take all those areas into account. And we tried to find a model that would bring together what it takes to raise parents and children together, as well as deal with addictions, trauma, and spiritual warfare, because we got very tired of all the different parts of the church fighting with each other about how it all ought to be done. So we figured that perhaps the one who designed us might have come up with an idea that would work for all of us. And so what we've tried to do is come up with a model that accomplishes that. And as a result, it's been spreading to different parts of the world. And with it, we have a study guide that has a lot of the details that you will find in the presentation we've made. The difference between this study guide and a lot of study guides is that it doesn't just repeat what's in the book, but it gives you additional information with the idea that you can take that and apply it to what's in the book in your own life. So we want people to be learning in a way that helps them to change their identity. Now, what are we going to be talking about today? Well, what we'll be discussing now is how addictions arise out of a catastrophic failure to reach adult maturity. The things that are really necessary for adult maturity are the things that are missing from people who are active in addictions. But since we don't really recognize maturity very well and what's required, we often don't recognize even the absence of that. But you will know that most addictions begin to develop and really express themselves in force, whether they're sexual or otherwise, when children are about 12 or 13 years of age. That's when you begin to find the great outbreak of addictions. And so it shouldn't be too surprising to you that this central engine that drives addictions has to do with something that's going wrong in their lives that's missing. And so we want to find out what are those missing things that they all need. To do this, we're going to go back and have you think about your first encounter with sexual addiction. For many people, the first shock was when they had a Christian leader, someone they knew or trusted, they found out they were having an affair. And so he was somebody who was in our life, we were having confidence in, and now we find out that they are what we call a moral failure. It's one of those things that it just happens all over the place, but when it happens close to us, we're just always so shocked, and then we don't want to talk about it. You find that a pastor or someone else has been involved with internet pornography. The internet pornography now is one of the top five problems for missionaries across the world. And it's also extremely high among pastors. And as we begin to look at this, you'll begin to find out why that's the case. For many people, their first real shock was when they found their husband with magazines or videos or on the internet. And the number of marriages that are in trouble because someone came and found what was going on with their husband is shocking, as well as the number of husbands that thought that when they got married it was going to solve this problem for them, and getting married really did nothing other than have them have to hide it at closer quarters than before. Then there's so many people who have been molested. Someone that you know could very well have been molested by someone, and what we're looking at here again is another form of sex addiction. Finding inopportune and inappropriate sexual objects. And the chances are that probably if this is the average audience, that somewhere between a quarter and a half of the people in the room have had personal contact this way, and the other people in the room are married to or very closely related to someone who has suffered from this problem. We've all had, I think in almost every family I've encountered, some spouse or child or relative that's been molested. Or we've had a mother who was exposed to sexual abuse of some kind of sexual addict behavior. or molested herself. And for many men, their first encounter was when they ran into some father or father's friend's magazines around the house. Now they're much more active, video and other sorts of things, but the number of men that tell stories about the sort of shocking experience that in many ways sort of marked their passage into being sexually conscious beings in their own lives, and it happened when they ran into someone's porn. And almost every man that you meet, if you got to know him very well, and he got to trust you, two things that are very unlikely with men, would tell you of his what he remembers of the shock of that first exposure to it. How does it feel for us? It's a very deeply felt experience, and it's if your encounter with a sexual addiction is always painful. People think about how did you feel when you the pastor or person or whoever it is was dealt with or abused by a sexual addict, and everyone agrees that it was painful. Most people experience some anger about it. The ones that feel the least anger about it are often the ones that are most brutally attacked themselves, but when we think about it in the lives around us, it becomes that way. For instance, a pastor at one of the churches that I was at ran off with one of the women that he was counseling, had an affair with her, left his wife and children, just at the time that my kids were adolescents and had just begun to form a relationship with him as the pastor of the church. And their reaction to trusting pastors and churches and being involved in the whole church thing was just, I mean, they just turned, you could see them turn away from the church and wanting to have anything to do with it because of the loss of trust they had that the man that they felt was guiding them had run off with someone else. Sex addiction come into the forefront. We feel out of control because we realize something is happening here that we can't stop, we can't deal with, and that the very best things about us are producing the worst pain and damage. In other words, the closer we are to somebody, the more it hurts to have sex addiction in that. If it happens to someone that we're very far from, it doesn't matter. And if it's someone that's very close to us, if it's our father or our grandfather or our husband or our son who is doing the sex addiction behavior, the closer they are to us, the worse it hurts. So the thing that should be bringing us the most joy, which is our closest intimate relationships, have suddenly become the source of the greatest pain that we have. And the reaction that people inevitably have to somebody who has gone off and done something, you find suddenly that they're with a prostitute or they have these internet pornography or they've got these other habits or they're doing something is, what was he thinking? What was going on? And in the middle of all of these feelings, there's a shocked reaction of how could somebody that says these things, believes these things, acts this way, suddenly be so completely off base in this area of their lives. For the sex addict themselves, the reaction is very much the same. He will say to you, what was I thinking? If you get close to them, and what you find that they're experiencing inside of their own addiction is pain, anger, a sense of loss of trust. They don't trust themselves anymore. They don't trust other people. They can't get close to anybody because what happens if the people around you find out what you're doing? And so there's a sense of being out of control. There's something that they're doing that they realize at one level, this is against everything that I stand for, believe, and want to do, and yet I'm off doing it. And that the very best things about them are producing the worst pain and damage. That is their own sexuality, which was designed for the greatest pleasure in their relationships, and it's supposed to be the basis of even transmitting life from one generation to the next. It's at the center of all the things that mean the most to you are now producing the most damage. And so the odd thing is, if you look at the sex addict and the sex addict victim, you get exactly the same set of feelings and the same question. What was I thinking? What was I doing? And this pattern that continues to run. Well, the answer to this begins to emerge when we look at the work of Giulio Tononi, who is a brain modelist, and Gerald Edelman, who got the Nobel Prize for his work on the brain. And they've been working on the area of consciousness. Now, this is essentially, they're trying to figure out what turns on the lights in your head, right? So what is it that your brain is doing when you're conscious of something? You're aware of something. This is what they've been studying. And so they've scanned some brains being conscious. And we're looking at some brain scans. Right now you're looking at the brain from above. And the nose would be right in the middle of that gap at the top, if you're looking at it. And that's the scan of the brain coming down here. And where it wraps around is where the brain kind of wraps around your ears. You don't really care about that a whole lot, because I'm not going to have a test at the end of this for you to interpret this. But what you want to notice is, look at the blue, red, and yellow. We can tell colors, right? Blue, red, and yellow. The blue part is a part of the brain that's not involved in consciousness at all. The red part is the part that's very involved in consciousness. And the yellow part is a part that's halfway involved and halfway uninvolved. Okay? And this brain is being conscious of one thing, red lines. Not very exciting. Who cares? It's not what you're being conscious of that matters particularly. But here's another brain, and they are, you look at the patterns, quite a bit different, isn't it? This brain is being conscious of red lines. Now this brain here, you notice the pattern, again, quite a bit different. It's being conscious of red lines, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this brain here is being conscious of, oh, I've got a bright audience here. So if you look at these four conscious minds, you'll realize that how each brain goes about being conscious of red lines is completely different from another, right? Everyone's state of consciousness about red lines is extraordinarily different. And while there's a lot of things we can talk about this, it's not particularly germane to our discussion. What is important to our discussion here today is that underneath all of this structure, Tononi and Edelman discovered what's called the dynamic core. This is a poor cat's brain up there that you're looking at. But this dynamic core is a set of structures that determines what you're conscious of and when. And so these are the things in your brain that turn on the lights, and they tell you, you can notice what's in front of you and it's personally relevant to you. Okay? If you turn off these structures, your lights go out, you're unconscious. If you turn them on, you can be conscious of something. You can notice things. And what these structures tell you to notice is what becomes your personal reality, what you are conscious of. Now, these structures happen to be exactly the same structures as those used for attachment. If you look at them down there, you might be able to read their labels. It doesn't matter, but you've got the thalamus and the parts of the basal ganglion. If you come over here to look at, whoops, I'm going backwards. That won't help us in this lecture. Got enough problems already. You look at the structure in the brain. We're looking at the attachment center of the brain, the ones that tell you who you love and care about, and those are the thalamus and the basal ganglion, the two areas that the arrows are pointing to. This is your brain's attachment center. And so it turns out that exactly the same structure that turns on your lights and tells you what you can be conscious of and what you can't is the same structure used to attach you to the important people of your life. That's one and the same unit. They are part of the brain's control center. The brain's control center is what does your emotional regulation, synchronization, and it's what produces your sense of identity. That is, it's a part of the brain that knows it's you. And the information about this comes out of Dr. Alan Shore's study. He has a number of books, and he's been called the Einstein of psychiatry because he's finally put together a theory that explains how the brain works with all kinds of other things that we've known it to work with before. But we never knew how. And so here we have a system that kind of puts it all together. And he's all written a number of books. The lecture that we have here, BrainWise, comes out of those books. So if you want to go look at them, that's a good thing to do. Now, I understand they're very hard books to read. So unless you really love reading brain science, don't particularly try. But if you really want brain science, one of the books, for instance, has got 200 pages in the back that are just footnotes. And you will get everything down to the mitochondrial level of how this all works. but I'm going to give it to you in something resembling English, I hope. This is the center that we're talking about, and it's a four-level control center, and it's hierarchical, which means that what happens at level one affects everything above it, two, three, four. And what happens at level two affects everything above it, three and four. And what happens at level three affects everything above it, which would be level four. And so it passes the information on, you see. So if you get something that affects, comes in at level one, it's going to affect the whole control center, right? Now, level one, let's review, is your attachment center and the part that creates your reality. So it's at the basis of your control center. It's right down there. It gets at things first, and whatever it does affects everything else that comes along. Now, this is a nonlinear model. What nonlinear model means is that a little effect at one place can produce a big effect someplace else. Any of you ever driven a car? Okay, we see a few people that have. And a few of us has a vague understanding about the car and how it might work, right? Here's how a nonlinear model would work. You're driving your car along in the daylight, and it's very bright outside, right? And then the sun sets, and it gets very dark, and everything is going on. There's this huge change in the light of the environment, but your driving doesn't change a whole lot from one to the other, right? Then one little itty-bitty tiny light about this big comes on your dashboard and says low fuel. And all of a sudden, there's this huge change in your driving behavior, you see? Or brakes no longer working, that little light, you know? And all of a sudden, there's this big change, and the light level didn't change a whole lot. But your brain is that kind of a device. A little tiny change can produce a big effect, or a great big huge change can produce almost no effect at all. And the earlier in the brain you put that effect in, the bigger effect it's likely to have. So we're looking at a brain where a little effect down here can have a huge effect up there. You starting to see where this might be going? The attachment and all those reality things all happen down at level one. And that affects the whole brain synchronization. And there's actually four plus levels of brain synchronization, the four levels in the control center. And then if all of that's running right, you get your left hemisphere thrown in for good luck. So we don't have an awful lot of time to talk about that, but what we're talking about is the nonverbal half of the brain is in control. And if it's all running right, it lets you have the world of words. And if it's not, your words are really not going to be all that important. Again, we're talking about why it is that words don't get a long ways with dealing with addictions and things that affect that the number one level of the brain. Because the words are in at 4+. And it's a hierarchical model. 4+ can affect 4+ and nothing else. Whereas anything at level one will affect everything above it. So level one tells you what and who is personal to me. That's what it's doing. All the stuff coming into your brain, you ignore most of it. Okay? All kinds of stuff in here. Now, on the back wall over there, on that side, there's a panel that's currently closed, and inside there's a number of levels in there and some buttons and stuff like that. None of you knew about that or cared about it at all until I pointed it out. I'm droning on about it now. But because that's what we use to turn the lights on and off for this presentation, I'm all familiar with that. When I walk in, I'm looking for that. It's personally relevant information to me because level one said so. But it wasn't to you until just now. Level two then tells us what we're supposed to do about that. Should we take that personally relevant information and approach it or avoid it? Personally relevant might be a bull is coming my way. I will have certain reactions to that, or it could be my wife coming my way. And, of course, depending on how we're getting along, it might not be a difference. Level three determines our energy level about it. Exactly how energized should I get about this personal reality? Is it something I should get way pumped up about it or just a little bit pumped up about it? And level four does the sequence in time. What went before this and what will come after this? And so where do I put this in my overall experience? And then 4+ gives us explanations about it, about what it is and what it means to me. And that is where most of our Christianity and theology ends up, over at level 4+. We've got all these words and explanations. Out of time. So what I'm going to recommend for you is The tapes are available, and a lot of this information is in your handout. So the details for a lot of this will be in the 16-page handout that goes with this lecture. So you might want to look in there too. But unfortunately, we'll move this at a rather brisk pace. Level one, if it malfunctions, your whole reality becomes painful. Everything about being alive is off. If your level two malfunctions, life is scary. At level three, you stay in distress. You just get upset, you stay upset. Level four is messed up, you stay immature. You're not developing a person over time. And if your level four plus synchronization is off, you have internal conflicts. And that's where most of us spend most of our time in counseling, talking with people about their internal conflicts. So every level of brain synchronization is represented by its own kind of pain. And there's a whole handout in there that you'll find that has all of these details on it for the four plus levels. What we want to focus on right now is that the brain structures at level one of the brain, the control center, not only control your consciousness, but your attachment and your addictions. And so we're going to look at how the addictions now affect exactly the same parts of the brain. When you are doing something as an addict, you are influencing your reality and attachment center. That's what addictions do. They mess with your attachment and reality center. And as we're looking at that in the brain here, you will see those to be that little green area there with the little orange spot in front that's called the nucleus accumbens. Now, level one of the brain, the part that we're talking about here, is the part, again, that says, who and what is personal to me? When I get to an airport, I flew into Mexico City a while ago, and I was expecting to get met by somebody. In other words, there are thousands of people in Mexico City Airport, and I'm looking at all of those faces, and I'm looking for one that I recognize. And a lady I knew came walking out of the crowd, and out of all those faces, that was personal reality to me. I couldn't tell you any of the other faces that were there in the whole airport, because that one meant something to me. That's this part of our brain that's looking at reality and saying, what about this is personally meaningful to me? That's what happens at level one. It's also the same thing that's called a dynamic core by our consciousness. So this part of your brain that says, this is personally relevant to me, then says, this is what I'm conscious and aware of. So according to what we do to that part of the brain, if we change what's personally relevant to me, we also shift with it what we're aware of. So all of a sudden, what we're aware of, processing, paying attention to, is a whole different reality than what we had going on before that. And so as people begin to get involved with their addictions, they're paying attention to the pleasure end of it, but they're not noticing that while that's happening, their personal reality is being shifted. And because it is their reality, they don't have anything else to compare with. So if you're doing this in isolation, there's no one to catch you. No one to tell you, you have drifted off course because your personal reality is not informing you of that. The first thing you notice when you've drifted off course is that you went and crashed big time. You just did something and afterwards you notice, I was never going to do that. This is completely outside my sense of reality. And you can't figure out how you got over there because you were affecting a part of your brain that's changing your reality, and so your monitor is out during the time that you're doing this. And that is how people in sexual addictions routinely get themselves in trouble. What they're messing with is their attachment circuit. Again, looking from the brain from above, you see the two parts of the attachment and reality circuit there, the thalamus and basal ganglion. The thalamus is the big lumpy in the middle, and the basal ganglion are those two little Mickey Mouse ears on top. And so we're messing with Mickey Mouse here. That's we're entering into a fantasy reality when we start to do this. We're changing our reality. By the way, this is a scan of a depressed brain from Dr. Amen. It's not his brain that's depressed, but he scanned it. And the reason that this person is depressed, now we look at the brain, we know why. This is their attachment center. It's depressed because the person they're attached to isn't available anymore. They are in attachment pain. The one I love is gone. Now, my mom died a couple of years ago, and afterwards you should have seen my dad. They'd been married for 55 years. He was in, and still is, every time you talk about my mom, it's not too far from a tear with him. He's in attachment pain. The one he loves isn't there. She won't wake up in the morning with him. She won't, fix another. There's nothing. And that's painful. And those of us who've experienced that attachment pain know that it's the basis for half the songs written. And probably without it, there wouldn't be a country western industry. The Mickey Mouse ears, the two little spots on top, are the basal ganglion. And that's the part that focuses your attention. It says, I only want you. So if I was to say to my dad, which would be really stupid, but if I was, I would say, Dad, you know, there's lots of fish in the sea. Why don't we go out and meet you some other fine women? His attachment center could care less about that, right? Because there's one and only woman for him, and he'll tell you so. And at 92, I think that's just fine. 90, I'm sorry. 90, it's still fine. But the basal ganglion locks into someone and says, you are the source of my bonds, and it becomes also the source of our reality. That's our personal, meaningful reality in people. So when we begin to train our basal ganglion what to lock into, which is what happens during addictions, we are now forming our personally relevant reality. And these are the same structures for bonding as for our attention. So our attention, you know, it isn't just where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. Where your attachment is, there will your attention be also. And so you turn your attention to the things that you become attached to. Addicts become attached to their addiction, as we'll see in a moment. So this attachment level is the number one level of the brain synchronization. It's the part of your brain that gives you your sense of belonging. And it's the part of a belonging has a spiritual dimension in that we only really know where we belong when we've been adopted into God's family. So unless our main attachment is to God and who he says we are, all the rest of the world doesn't make particularly good sense. And so we need to have that sense of attachment to God in order to have a reality that's focused on God. I had a preacher one time who asked in a sermon what I consider to be a very bad question. You know, sometimes the questions you ask can really make or break you, but in this question, he said, what did the early church believe that allowed them to let their wives and children and themselves be killed and be glad to do it? And I think that's the wrong question, because the part of your brain that would be in charge would care less what you believe. The question would be, who do you love that would allow you to go through this? Who do we care about? That's the part of your brain that we're talking about here. Who do you love? Who do you care about? Who are you attached to? That part of the brain that we're talking about is the attachment circus. It says, who or what's personal to me? And it creates our personal reality. And when our personal reality is focused on the wrong thing, our entire existence becomes painful. And so now we're looking at the condition that's underlying addictions. There's a painful sense about reality that is being covered up by whatever the addiction might be. When it malfunctions, it distorts your whole reality. That's the point I want to keep making over and over. A malfunction of your attachment circuit will distort your whole reality. Now, the whole thing is that someone from the outside may know that your reality is distorted, but inside, you may not be aware of how distorted it is. Because it's your reality. And you know what? It's very, very hard for any of us to trust somebody else and their sense of reality more than our own. Just try it with somebody. Try to tell them that something that they really believe ain't true, isn't there, isn't going on. And it is really hard to do it, you know? Go tell somebody whose sense of reality doesn't include demonization, all about the demonization and everything you've witnessed. and see what happens. You see? Trust my reality more than yours. I don't think so. We're very, very possessive about that. And to recover, you need a couple of bonded relationships, but we're not going to talk about that. So in order to understand the addictions, we realize then that people who didn't develop a reality system, attachment system that works right, won't reach a well-functioning adult maturity, deal with the nucleus accumbens, return to joy from the big six feelings, and they won't really recognize attachment pain. And that's really the one we're starting with here. You have this unrecognized attachment pain that's underneath all of the addictions. Now, attachment pain works this way. The closer you are to the person, the worse it hurts. So those of you who are married, your spouse can hurt you in ways that nobody else on earth can hurt you. And the follow-up is your kids. And on top of that, it's maybe your parents. But you see, the closer they are, the more you love them, the more you care about them, the more you're attached to them, the more it can hurt. And so we're dealing with the most sensitive part of us, you see. And when we're talking about sexual addiction, we realize that the one who should comfort us is the source of the pain. The very one, you see, if your husband's had an affair as a part of a sexual addiction, or he's been out with prostitutes again, or he's brought home a sexually transmitted disease and you've got it now, the very one that you need to have comfort you the most is the one that introduced this problem. And it produces a very, very difficult situation, because the closer you get to them, the more upset you get. You see, this is what's called a disorganized attachment. In other words, we can't make sense of it inside. If you're the cause of my pain, the closer I get to you, instead of being comforted, the worse it hurts. Now, do I get closer to you or do I get away from you? If I get away from you, there's no comfort. And if I get close to you, there's more pain. Now, this is also the case for the person with the sexual addiction. Okay? The exact person that would need to comfort you the most is the one that you've just hurt the most. So if you want to get comforted, you have to go and talk to the person you just hurt the most about what you just did to hurt them the most in order to be comforted. And how are you going to get that to work? You see, the people you need to comfort you most are the people from your church. So you're going to go chat with them about your sexual addiction. Go, you know, folks, I really hurt you a lot with my sexual addiction, and let me go talk. You see, we don't want you close with us. That's the kind of stuff you're doing. And so it becomes very, very confusing, because the very most intimate thing about us is also the source of the pain. Consequently, the difficulty in unraveling it at all. And if you have a sexual addiction, or sexual abuse later in life that shows up, it reactivates old disorganized attachment. What that means is, let's suppose as a child you are a little bit afraid of your parents. And so you never quite knew what to do with your dad when he was mad. And so now you have... Your husband gets mad every time you talk to him about his sexual addiction, right? What do you do? What activates that old pattern of being afraid of your dad when he got mad? Or suppose that your dad always got mad to you and you're the sexual addict. And every time you mention it to your wife or pastor or someone like that, they get mad. That gets that same disorganized feeling. Well, what am I going to talk to them about it? Because they get mad at me, then I don't know what to do. And the same sense of disorganization keeps setting in. So if this was set even about anger early on in life, when you add another problem to it, like sexual addiction, you activate that old problem again. Now you still don't know how to solve it. And so what do people do? Well, they avoid it, right? And they hide it. And they try to cover up what's going on inside. What that means is that they continue to not belong. So the sex addict has an ongoing experience of not belonging. He might look like he belongs. He might act like he belongs. But inside, he secretly knows that if you know what I did, you'd throw me out. So I don't really belong. And there's also that kind of a veil on the other side of the with partners and close people, because there's some part of the person's life that they're locked out of. They know that somehow or another, they don't belong fully in all the parts of this person's life and soul and mind. The pain of not belonging means that you're lonely, you feel unloved, unwanted, uncared for, uncaring, sometimes impersonal and cold, and untouched or unreachable. These are all ways of dealing with attachment pain. One way, the attachment pain is always on, so you're always hurting. And the other way, you get cold and distant and try to act like you could care less about such things, so it never has to hurt. Now, what actually happens, of course, if you act cold and distant, act like it never has to hurt, is not that the pain goes away. You have just trained yourself not to pay attention to it. Attachment pain turns on, and it's from the part of your brain that turns on and off your reality. So you've now messed with your reality, so you won't notice it. Is it still there? Yes, it's still there. Does it still drive your behavior? Yes, it still drives your behavior. Do you know what's going on? Not a clue. You've hidden it from yourself. You're completely blotto to the fact that you have attachment pain at all. If you were asked about it, you go, no, I don't care about that. I don't feel anything. I don't feel all that much from away from my kids or my or whatever else it is. Or about myself, you just are disconnected from it. And that means you've now distorted your own existence, which is what you need to do if you want to fail to thrive. So we're looking at sexual addictions again, and we're discovering that they develop from unrecognized attachment pain, the underlying cause of it all is that you don't recognize attachment pain. When you really need to connect with somebody, an addict is not thinking, boy, I really need to connect with somebody. They're thinking, where am I going to get it? Now, it is not a somebody. And so their reality is tweaked from there. If they said, boy, I'm really hurting because I need a relationship right now, they might come up with a better solution. But that's not what's going on in their brain because they don't recognize attachment pain. They're also dealing with an untamed nucleus accumbens, and we'll know a little bit about that after our next lecture. But we'll say enough about it here to say your nucleus accumbens is the part of your brain that gives you the I'm going to die if I don't get it craving. And this time, to agree with the devil, you shall not surely die. If you disregard, if you don't give in to that craving, it isn't going to kill you. But until you learn to face that craving, it will. And so this is one time when the devil wants you to believe you will surely die. If you don't face that ever, you don't know that you could actually survive a little attachment pain and maybe find a solution for it. And then there's the inability to return to joy. Once something goes wrong in your relationships, you don't know how to fix it. See, I had an uncle who bought a new car. And no one in my family ever bought new cars. We were missionary kids. I mean, a new car, I'd never seen a new car. It was a wonderful new car with all the fancy buttons and everything. It was so clean. I've never seen a car like that. And one day he said to me, let's go get some bait to go fishing. I said, but it's been raining and the road's muddy. Your car is going to get dirty. And my uncle looked at me. He said, yeah, so, well, we can wash it. And all of a sudden, the world just opened up to me as a world of possibilities. You know, something could go wrong, but you could fix it. And all that worrying about stuff didn't have to happen anymore. You see, if you had a relationship in which you said something went wrong, but no problem, we'll fix it, you would head off to fixing it. But if something goes wrong and you don't know what to do about it, now you're in a different sort of problem. And how do you get close to somebody when things have gone wrong? Addicts don't know how to do that, especially when they're feeling shame or sad. Sad is particularly true for sex addicts. They're some kind of loss, and they're just not very good at getting close to people when they've had a sense of loss, especially if they're involved in that loss. So how do they disrupt their own attachment response? They do it by misdirecting their attachment. So what they do is instead of being attached to people, they move their attachment over to something that they can control. If you can't control people, and they do refuse to be controlled, you will attach to something you can control, like the mouse on your computer. The way you do that is you get attached to your own rush. See, whatever gives you your own rush actually turns on the pleasure center in your nucleus accumbens. And so what happens with whatever gives you a rush, your nucleus accumbens comes on and you go, ah, that's the thing that I wanted. And so you can do that. You can misdirect your rush by attaching it to objects or short-term people. What do I mean short-term people? Porn stars. I mean, I don't usually say this in mixed audiences, but short-term people are people that are being used for sexual purposes here. You know, they're people that you use to get a rush from. And the idea is to get the biggest rush you can from them. You're not attached to them as a person. You're attached to whatever pleasure you think they can produce for you. When you do that, you block your own attachment response. You see, your brain only has one button, one light to signal whether you have pain or pleasure. And you use it for everything. And so if you can get that light to go off because you gave it sexual pleasure, the light is off. Even though it was on because it wanted attachment, it's now temporarily off. And so you've gotten it to turn off. What a wonderful thing! You know, that nagging something that was always there bothering me is gone. Whatever I did, that was the thing right there. And so it blocks the nucleus accumbens. Your nucleus accumbens is basically an idiot light. You know, those of you who really like gauges on your car, you know what I mean when you say it's an idiot light? Because, in fact, I got in my car, I got one light that gives me the messages for every last thing that goes wrong in the car. If the oil is low, it's the same light. If it's something says like service engine soon, right? It could mean anything in the world. You know, I don't know what's gone wrong. It just says service engine soon. It's blinking there. You go, oh, this could be expensive, is what I'm thinking right there. But that one little light you see is where your nucleus accumbens is. Once it goes off, it doesn't matter what turned it off. If somebody went under my hood, snipped that wire so it wasn't on again, I'd go, oh, phew, it's running, you know? Everything is fine. Because I'm too stupid to know better, right? This is what we do when you turn your nucleus accumbens off with these other things. It's off, you go, oh, phew, that's better now. You can do that with drugs. Or what we're looking at here, orgasm-centered sexual activity. Anything that produces an orgasm will turn off the nucleus accumbens briefly. And by doing that, you have blocked whatever the pain might have been. And so now all you've got to do is keep that going, and you're not going to be in pain anymore. Et voila. Seems like genius. So why is it unrecognized? Well, first it has to be... accumbens is subcortical. And what that means is that it's part of your brain that is not directly wired to... We're all consciously aware of the trauma. So, the same way with your body's sense of temperature. Battery? Okay. Pause.
Take a break.
I'm back on now?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good to be back. Yeah. So, do you ever pay attention to how you learn not to wet the bed at night? Now, some part of your brain knows how big, how full your bladder is, right? Even while you're asleep, right? And you can learn to control and train that because someone bothered to spend a lot of time potty training you. But if they hadn't done that, what are the chances that all on your own you would have figured out how to do that or even care about it till you bought your own bed? See? And at that point, you know, it can be trained. A part of your brain knows how to do it, is very much aware. But if I asked you where and how, none of us could tell you exactly, right? It's over there someplace in the control center. It's subcortical. It can be trained, and you can learn to be aware of it. And if any of you have ever tried to potty train a kid, there's this time when they're just not aware that they got to go to the bathroom. And you can look at them, and they're hopping and jumping. You go, if I don't get this kid to the bathroom soon, they're going to wet their pants again. But you ask them about it, you have to go? No? Mm-hmm. Well, go. You know, and because we're it's subcortical, you have to learn to recognize it. And after a while, I think all of us here have learned it, right? And we're so glad. Same thing with attachment pain. It's the same sort of thing. It's obscured by insecure attachments. What that means is, if the people that you are trying to feel attached to do a bunch of odd stuff, sometimes it hurts to be around them, sometimes they're available, all times it's not, no one's explaining this to you, pretty soon you just can't make sense of the whole thing. Why is it that sometimes this I feel, sometimes I feel that way? I'm not identifying it. I just never know when it's going to happen, when it's not going to happen. It becomes very confusing for me. Now, I remember one particular case of no story being told about it. It was a lady who was in grade school, and her parents had never talked about attachment at all. And they had to go to the hospital in a distant city to take one of their children who was having a medical emergency, and they left her with some neighbors. And she sat at the window, looking out the window all the time that her parents were gone, and feeling eminently terrible about it, but not knowing what was going on. And she remembers the day that the neighbor lady walked in and sat down and said to her, "You really miss your parents, don't you?" And at that point, something inside all made sense. Oh, that's why I'm sitting here in the window. That's what this feeling is. I'm missing my parents. Yes, that is exactly right. And no stories had ever been told about it. Until someone put it into words for her, she couldn't identify that that's the distress she was in. But after that, she's been able to talk about it. And every time she misses somebody, she says, yeah, this is like when I missed my parents. She can tell the story. She has words for it. She's been identified. And you see, to do that for the nucleus accumbens, it gets even more confusing because it's a general purpose attachment center and pleasure center. It gives you your I'm going to die cravings. But you see, you can get that same craving for food and air. And we usually identify the one when we're hungry, right? But did you know that a lot of the times when people's brain registers they're hungry, they're actually thirsty? And so if people drank water when they are feeling this craving for food, an awful lot of times, you wouldn't have the craving for food because you've actually misinterpreted the attachment center. You're used to thinking, well, that's hunger, and so you take it and you give it some food, and along with the food, you happen by chance to drink some water, and so your brain registers, oh, that took care of it. So you've just mistrained it there, you see. And also, you're craving for air. Now, that's actually one where you're more likely going to die. So, you know, it's there's an urgency about it, and as a result, most people get that one right. But when it comes to attachment, it's not nearly so visible from the outside what it is that you might be missing, you see. Now, people actually identify a lot better than you might think, because they often say about fussy kids, he only wants attention. And so they've correctly named it, but the solution they gave them for it is completely unhelpful to the attachment center. So they identify it as a bad thing, which they ought to not have, and find some other way of further hiding it from other people so that they won't go around saying you need attention. What they should say is they need attachment. And so they obviously don't know how to get attachment without bothering everybody around them. So there's somebody who's already on their way to an unmet need, you see. Now, sex also turns this off. So every time there's an orgasm, it blocks the signals going through the... It takes over, essentially, and it dominates the... nucleus accumbens, and drugs will do the same thing. So any of those things take that idiot light and they control it while they're in charge. Now, unrecognized attachment pain often leads to the sexual abuse of children. Why is this? Well, because abusers are often feeling genuine attachment feelings and needs. They will usually abuse the children to whom they have a desire to attach. And so a grandfather will appropriately look at a grandchild and feel the desire to attach. That turns on their brain's nucleus accumbens, which they identify as a sexual urge because that's what they use to turn it off. And so they then turn that pain off by doing something sexual. That's what they've been doing for years and years and years. Now, was that what the actual original message was? No, and you've just started a painful process which is going to do all kinds of damage and produce the kind of results that will make it even further confusing. Because what happens to the addict? Well, in fact, it did turn off their attachment pain briefly, and that is to say it blocked it, so they thought that worked. And immediately afterwards, there's this flood of all this other sort of stuff, and they don't feel attached to the child again. So what do you have to do? Because now you're back in pain again. Well, do it again. And so you have this compulsively doing it over and over and over and over again, because the light doesn't stay off all that long when you've used the wrong thing to turn it off. It just is off for a few seconds, actually. You ask sexual addicts, how long is it after your orgasm before you start feeling crummy again? And it's seconds. You know, and now we got to turn that pain off again because it's only been blocked. And so what we have when we're trying to figure out what they were thinking, you see, because they have altered their own personal reality by using sexual stimulation to turn off the attachment pain, they have changed the way they think about the world. The way you get out of pain, the way you make things better is by pursuing something that will give you orgasm. And that becomes your way of understanding all of the people in your life and all the objects in your life, everything that might trigger attachment pain. So the more likely you are to attach to someone, the more likely you are to sexually abuse someone. And that is a formula for disaster in families if there ever was one. And what more, it means that the people who genuinely want to attach with you are more likely to elicit your abusive response. So that's the people who really care about you and are really glad to be with you that are most likely going to be targeted. Now, there's a plan from hell if I ever heard one. Right? See, God meant for all of our reality to be personal. That's why he put together our reality center and our attachment center in the same place. He meant for us to personally care about everything we were aware of. And when he's at the center of that, it works out pretty good. And when he's not, we've got hell to pay. When people begin using their sexual response to block attachment pain, they become attached to whatever produces their excitement. So now they're attached to pornography, to whoever their partners might be. How did somebody end up having an affair with somebody? Well, that was the person they were using to turn off their attachment pain. And very soon, what happens? Their attachment center is responding to that person. You're the one who's turning off my pain. They're changing their personal reality computer without knowing it. That's this dynamic core that Tononi and Edelman were telling us about. Their basal ganglia now begins to say, I only want you. Because remember, it's very specific. Once we're attached to somebody, only them will do. You see, my wife has a little thing about chocolates, which, by the way, are a carbohydrate and very good for turning off the nucleus accumbens. So I went out, being the ignorant husband that I was, and I bought her a box of very expensive chocolates. Yeah, I said, I'm going to get her attachment response going for me, right? Yeah, I'll just duplicate this. Dumb me, I bought dark chocolate. Her light does not go on for dark chocolate. Doesn't matter how much I paid for it or the brand or anything else or the fact that the store said this is the best brand made. It was dark chocolate. She does not switch on a light for dark chocolate. Milk chocolate. That will get her light on. And, you know, there are certain milk chocolates now that are better than others. I mean, I now know which ones. But I only want you come into focus. You see, the basal ganglion said, chocolate, dark, that's not the one. It's very specific, you see. And it's very well, very carefully trained by all of us. And with chocolate, we can laugh. And I'm using that example because when we start talking about the stuff that you can get focused on for sexual addictions, it ain't particularly funny. Because this new mother is what's telling you what's real. Now the thing that you've attached to begins to be the interpreter of your reality. Is it a woman at the office? Your feelings about her begin to interpret your reality. Is it the phone sex? The telephone and seeing a telephone begins to interpret your reality. All of those things become the interpreter of what's real to you, what really matters to you, What is it that you really want if I gave you the thing you want the most? Here's the answer. Your nucleus accumbens and your attachment center is telling you. So, any questions? Let's see. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. Is that right? So, 6 minutes? Okay. Let me give you one or two guidelines for questions. First is, I don't want any personal questions about you or any relatives or any other cases or people that you've counseled and things like that. If you do, I'll cut you off. I'll say this isn't the context to do that sort of thing in. There's plenty of things to give personal places to give personal questions. Taped court sessions aren't the place to do it. And all of us have them, so it's not bad that you have them. It's just that this isn't the place to do it. Secondly, if you make your questions very brief, it's very helpful to people who are listening to the tape and the ones sitting here as well. So if you have a question about something that you've heard presented, you can make it brief and without making it personal. That's the kind of questions we're looking for right here. Yes?
Could it be from what you said that a lack of attachments for the child by the time they're 2 years old or at a very young age is one of the day and time we live because of most mothers taking their children to daycare, is this kind of thing can have an effect on sexual education?
Okay, very good question. Could the mothers taking their children to daycare these days, and that the effect of that on attachment prior to age two have a big effect on sexual addiction? The answer is most certainly. And to that we can also add that not only does that produce children who are very low on joy, but children who have a relatively hopeless feeling about achieving attachment. You see, if you're going to have to wait 8 hours to see the person you're attached to, during that 8 hours, the child's brain is registering that I'm not going to get what I need for a very long time. And that tends early on in life to produce a fair amount of hopelessness. Later on in life, it has a different effect. But early on in life, you're not ready to wait 8 hours. And so it produces a sense of hopelessness. I'll never get what I need. And finally, because children who are getting that kind of attachment treatment are usually set in front of TV sets for a very long time. The thing that you do respond to, because it'll at least obscure your gnawing craving for a while, is the TV set. And of course, you probably heard a study by now that indicates that studied 5-year-olds, four or 5-year-olds, and well over 75% of them, when asked, would you rather have your father or a television set, elected the television set. Because they're, in fact, much more attached to the television set than their fathers. Again, this is a hopelessness about attachment. So it isn't just the mother working, but it's also the uninvolvement of the father in the children's lives that increases the sense of hopelessness. So that's a very good question. Yes, over here.
Are you saying that attachment disruption hinders people from recognizing their primary affect?
Okay, the question is, does attachment disruption hinder people from recognizing their primary affects? And the primary affects are essentially the subcortically run parts of their emotional system that really determine your basic sense of well-being and being. And the answer is very directly yes. The attachment at level one will disrupt everything above it and your sense of reality about it. And it's also the best known method to scrabble people's ideas about their primary affect and make them hard to locate and identify, and even more so to soothe. So you not only will have trouble identifying what you're really feeling, but as we will see in the returning to joy section, you have a very hard time calming yourself down if you're upset too. Yes? Right, and again, the question is about the generation that grew up with the very distant don't hold or touch your baby's whole idea of how you raise children. Will that disrupt their attachment? And the answer is yes, and it makes it very hard for them to identify when they actually are in attachment pain. Because long before you had words, you begin to discover ways of hiding it. And the research indicates that by 18 months of age, babies are able to fake their attachment pain issues. And that by 18 months of age, you can act like you don't have it when you have it and be very good at doing it, really. And so while it's still going on inside, your heart is still beating and you're still having all the pain that can be monitored physiologically. If you look at that baby outside, they look like they haven't a thing going on with them. And so babies that are trained very early on are taught to ignore it. And consequently, people from that generation have a beastly hard time identifying when they're having attachment pain at all. And they'd be inclined to tell you they don't have it because consciously that would be exactly true. They can't identify it. Yes?
Would you say that individuals that have like multiple personality disorders, that there's always or the majority of
Well, it is getting off the topic a little bit. We'll answer the question anyway. The question is what I say with people with multiple personality disorders, or as they're called currently, dissociative identity disorders, is that connected with attachment? And the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. Multiple identity and those kinds of problems happen at brain level synchronization 2. Attachment's at level 1. What happens at level 2 that's significant is that, there's the beeper. What happens at level 2 that's significant is that you're trying to avoid pain. And if the number one source of pain in our life is attachment, there's nothing like attachment pain to make a child want to dissociate early on. And so anything that disrupts that is going to increase your chances of being dissociative. Okay, thank you very much. We're going to take a break, and I'll have to see you later.